named Ed Connolly. He's a researcher here in the Bay Area who has written an article in the most recent issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, and specifically, one of his areas of expertise concerns the state defense forces that we've spoken about before. There is going to be a hearing with regard to funding for the California State Defense Force. I believe it's tomorrow. We have Ed on the line here, and he's going to give us some information about these particular hearings, and in particular about what people can do perhaps to influence the outcome of these hearings, or at least to affect the outcome of the situation with regard to the California Defense Forces. People are often calling up the program either on the air or afterwards and saying, well, yeah, okay, I listened to the information that you present and I pretty much believe what you're saying, but what can we do about it? Well, here's an example of something that people may be able to have a concrete effect on. Hello, Ed, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here, Dave.
Okay, listen, you're on the air, so why don't you tell people about the upcoming hearings and about why they may want to take an interest in this particular issue.
Okay, thank you for having me on and spreading the word about this. I do have that article running now for reference about the State Defense Forces, which State Defense Force is a generic name, as your audience may be aware, for volunteer paramilitary groups that are sanctioned here in California and in 25 other states. They go by different names in different states. They all operate under a common mission conceived by the Department of Defense back at the beginning of the Reagan presidential administration, and specifically that mission is to suppress so-called civil disorder and fight domestic terrorists and subversives in the event the National Guard is federalized and mobilized for foreign combat. They operate at something called cadre strength now, which means there's a cap on their membership of approximately 1,500 people in each state during peacetime. And that cadre is a nucleus of officers who would marshal people either who would volunteer or people who would be conscripted by a state draft. Here in California, for example, the governor has the authority to draft to augment the cadre to full mobilization strength. And in this state, the full mobilization strength during a declared emergency is 20,000 citizens. And they would be drafted from the so-called unorganized militia, which is a pool of able-bodied males who don't have commitment to other armed service, who are between 18 and 45 years old. So that covers a lot of people here in our state. In California, the State Defense Force is known as the California State Military Reserve. And of all the State Defense Forces, it's one known, at least from the Pentagon perspective, is one of the premier State Defense Forces, kind of a model for others. They're very active here in the Bay Area and throughout the state. There are 12 battalions.
Ed, before let me interrupt for just a second.
Yeah.
Why is it that the California State Defense Force is viewed as a model? What specific aspects of this force, as opposed to some of the others, have it as a sort of a paragon?
Well, simply because it tends to be more well-organized than the others, and this one is very poorly organized. So as kind of the national paradigm, it really is not a terrific model. It has something to do with the people who are involved in its formation and the relationship with the National Guard office within the Pentagon that stimulated the revival of these things in their current iteration a few years ago. And there's been involvement at the high command level with a private group that's called the State Defense Force Association of the United States, which operates out of Kansas City. I know you're getting on to a prepared section of the program, and I don't know how much or how little of this you may have covered in the past in your programs. I'm really a new listener. I was referred by the San Jose Peace Center.
We have
to the point.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
The Maxine Waters, Assemblywoman Maxine Waters, Ways and Means Subcommittee on State Administration will be hearing testimony by the officers in command of the California State Military Reserve, that is California State Defense Force, tomorrow in Sacramento at 4 o'clock. In fact, the entire military budget for the state will be heard by them, and I will be testifying at the hearing about citizens' concerns about the California State Military Reserve, its missions, and its activities. I should point out that mobilization plan, which is the 125-page guideline for what this group does if it is ever called up to active duty by the governor, was published in January as a result of a six-month project by a so-called Blue Ribbon Committee that was appointed under the governor's authority to actually draft this working document. They finally got around to publishing it in January, and it's pretty hair-raising to read. It includes keeping intelligence files on groups and individuals of interest to the command, documents what happens during the mobilization, where there is a boot camp set up at Camp San Luis Obispo, which is a distribution point for federal arms, and recruits there would be trained in the use of riot control gases and crowd control and would be equipped with M14s and 45 caliber sidearms. So it's quite an adventure reading the mobilization plan, and not really too many people even in the state government are aware of this agency, and that's the function of this Ways and Means hearing. All the government agencies have to go before Ways and Means on the House side each year in order to have their funding validated. Typically what happens with a military budget is that I guess the adjutant general comes in and just lays out what the military expenditures are going to be, and then it's just proceeded in a routine way to passage, and no one has ever appeared from the state military reserve. It's always been lumped into the state budget. So this is the first opportunity, public opportunity, to get testimony from these guys about what they're up to, and to really bring some public scrutiny to it. Now, I've tried to be, I've done a lot of work in contacting the wire services and some of the larger papers with staffs up in Sacramento, so that this thing wouldn't occur in a vacuum, and I'm very happy that you've given me the opportunity to spread the word on your program. So if anyone has an interest in attending this hearing, I know it's pretty short notice, but it's at 4 o'clock at the State Capitol Ways and Means Subcommittee. I wrote an article that will be appearing in the San Jose Mercury about this, hopefully on Tuesday.
Ed, tell you what, let me interject a couple of things, a couple of questions that I would like to ask.
Sure.
And have you kick around a little bit for the benefit of the audience as well as myself. Then at the end of that particular discussion, I would like you to give any particulars, in other words, about the upcoming Mercury article, about your article on covert action, and about telephone numbers and or addresses or specifics that people can address in terms of actually getting busy in a hands-on sense with regard to this particular issue.
I'd be glad to do that.
Okay. Something, when we spoke during the week, something that interested me, and I don't know if you feel comfortable talking about this on the air, let me be sort of equivocal about how I say this for that reason. We spoke about a scheme which you had heard about and which turned out to be real, concerning a means of distributing firearms to the civilian population involving, in essence, paramilitary activity by the part of a well-known national firearms lobby. Would you feel comfortable in discussing that on the air?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have probably some more information than I had when we talked last, and I'll be very specific about it and give you some phone numbers so your audience might want to follow up on this.
Again, before you proceed, Ed, I just want to say that we haven't specifically worked out, you know, what we're going to talk about here, so I didn't know if Ed felt comfortable talking about that. Go ahead.
Well, as a result of the article that I did in Covert Action about the State Defense Forces, the editor I worked with, Lou Wolf, there, had gotten some correspondence from a source who regularly contributes to the magazine, apparently. Now, I don't know who that is, because the letter that he forwarded to me didn't have a return name or address on it or anything. Not that that should make much difference. But the letter that he had forwarded, which stemmed from an investigation his reader had done into stuff that I had talked about in the article on State Defense Forces, indicated that he had some friends in the Midwest who were involved in military stuff, and that he had been told that if you were a member of the National Rifle Association, of the NRA, and gained sharpshooter qualification, which apparently, you know, you have to do a lot of target shooting and get a good score, and as a result, you get a sharpshooter qualification. You then are able to get a form, and the form is a form from the military department, from the Department of Army, that you can fill out to request an M1. An M1 is a standard issue military rifle through the Second World War and Korean War. I think it was the rifle that shot the students at Kent State that the guardsmen had. And it sounded pretty far-fetched to me. Somehow he suggested in the letter, that is the person who had corresponded with Lou Wolf and who Lou had, you know, forwarded his letter to me. I called Lou Wolf a covert action. I said, well, look, you know, I guess you probably don't discount anything these days, but this sounds a little bit haywire to me, although anything is possible. And he said, well, look, the guy's a reliable source. He has been in the past. Maybe there's some substance to it. Well, I don't know anybody who's in the NRA, so I decided to go to the NRA offices in Washington out of curiosity. I just gave him a call. Lo and behold, it's stone true. It's absolutely true. I don't know what bearing it may have or may not have on state defense forces, but according to the NRA, it's indeed true that if you are a qualified sharpshooter, you can get a form, and in fact, they are forwarding the form and some information to me. I don't know whether they're forwarding the form because I'm not a sharpshooter. For that matter, I'm not in the NRA, but there's forwarding information. And they've indicated that it's the director of civilian marksmanship at the Pentagon who's under whose authority this program works. Well, in fact, there is a director of civilian marksmanship in the Pentagon. The number is area code, well, let me give you the 800 number. It's 800-248-1512. If that does not answer, then it's area code 202-272-0810.
Ed, could you give us that one more time slowly for people that are trying to write it down?
Yeah. It's the Director of Civilian Marksmanship. There are two numbers. If you want to spend a nickel, it's area code 202-272-0810. The other number is 800-248-1512. Now, you'll reach something called the M1 program and ask for Ms. Williams. Apparently, here's the deal. If you're a qualified sharpshooter in the NRA, and apparently there's some other subordinate gun groups that you can belong to qualify for this thing. There's one group in California called the Gun Owners of America, I think she had mentioned. In any case, you send in the form. There was no mention of an investigation of your criminal record or anything of that sort. And you are qualified to buy a reconditioned M1, which was Second World War, Korean War vintage, for $165. It's a .30-06 caliber. And
excuse me, let me interject something at this point for people that are not familiar with this particular weapon. It is a semi-automatic rifle and has the same basic mechanism, although not nearly as large a magazine, as the weapons that are currently the object of so much fuss and which are being banned. One of the things that I found so interesting about that information, Ed, was that at the same time, as we're seeing semi-automatic rifles being banned, at least the import of them and the restriction of their sale to the public, the NRA and the military is distributing these things to individuals of their choosing.
Yeah, that's right, Dave. That's the thing that really strikes me as very peculiar, that, you know, on the one hand, there's a public policy of restricting, well, of course, it's restricting the importation of foreign-made guns, which I guess gives ultimately some economic advantage to the domestic manufacturers, but you know, the fact that on one hand there's a public policy of restricting these things and really being very, you know, very deliberate and very somber and very serious publicly about it, but at the same time the Department of the Army is doling these things out at a cut rate. Now, I, not being a real gun expert, I called one of the local gun shops. I picked an ad out of the Yellow Pages that had a machine gun illustrated, you know, on their ad, so I figured that they probably have a line on this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy knew immediately what I was talking about as far as the weapon was concerned. It's an M1 Garand, G-R-A-N-D.
Actually, I think it's G-A-R-A-N-D. Garand was the name of the fellow who invented it.
Yeah, you're right. I'm wrong.
I'm not trying to engage in one-upsmanship, but just for the purposes of documentation, that was actually the last time the fellow who invented it.
I didn't mean to suggest that you were, but I figured that I had it wrong.
But no, that was for the benefit of some listeners who will accuse me of just about anything, not for you. Go ahead.
The guy at the gun shop said, well, yeah, it's a very, very accurate weapon. It's semi-automatic, as you said. But he said, interestingly, he said, out of all the guns you could pick, that one is about the easiest one to convert to fully automatic firing. And he told me that they had a couple in that were really beat up a couple of weeks ago in his gun shop. In bad condition, they sold them for nearly $400 a piece. And the Pentagon versions are reconditioned, and they're being sold for $165. I happened to be at a dinner party the same night that I found out about this, and I was talking to a middle-aged woman about it. And she said, well, you know, my husband, when he got out of the Marines in 1945, had heard of a similar program. She thought it was through the NRA, but wasn't really sure. But in any case, it involved federal weapons and filling out a form, and he filled out the form. He never did get the gun, and she was relieved about that. But maybe there's some precedence to this. Maybe there's a reasonable explanation, but I can't think of it. Can you?
Well, the thing that I wonder, honestly, one of the things I'm going to be talking about during the coming prepared portion are a couple of aspects, and I'm not suggesting that the historical analogy is perfect in any way, but there are a couple of very prominent characteristics of the current American political situation, which I think are ominously similar to the situation in Weimar Germany. And there are actually a number of interesting comparisons, but in particular, I'm worried about our economic situation, and in particular, if all of the debt crises currently confronting this country were to precipitate an economic collapse, and that's something I don't think we can rule out, and far wiser economic heads than mine have predicted something like that at some point. I just wonder whether or not this country's reactionary right and our national security establishment will react in a fashion analogous to the way the German national security establishment reacted. Eichmann, who was the head of Amt 4B, the SS institution in charge with overseeing the liquidation of the Jews in Europe, was very candid in a lot of his writings, as were a number of the top Nazis, that in fact the Jews were not to blame for Germany's problems, but it was absolutely essential for the maintenance of Third Reich political hegemony both in and out of Germany to have a significant political scapegoat on whom to blame a whole variety of ills, such as Germany's reduced situation in the world with regard to the Treaty of Versailles, the economic hardships of the inflation of the early 20s, and then the Great Depression, and so forth. I worry about how this country will react if we have a depression. I don't see the current direction of this society being a very humanistic one, George Bush's kinder and gentler nation notwithstanding. It is my fear, and again, I'm not saying it's absolutely certain to happen, but it is my fear that something like that could happen in the United States in the event that we were to have a Great Depression. If a large number of Americans were to find themselves suddenly very, very poor, I think the kind of political scapegoating that we're seeing with David Duke, who was written up in Covert Action, among other places, as having a lot of interesting connections to the intelligence agencies, perhaps even being an agent himself, I think that kind of an appeal could go a lot farther than it goes at this time, and certainly that people of that type, people of the World Anti-Communist League type of view, have a significant voice in the national security establishment today, as they always have. In particular, or in addition, I should say, I'm worried about something that I think another analogy between the situation in this country and Weimar Germany that I think is epitomized by the Oliver North phenomenon. Ali, when he was up there in front of those hearings, the real source of his appeal, I think, was a combination of his uniform and his defiance of what was perceived to be an ineffectual public authority. One of the things which permitted the overthrow of the Weimar Republic was the fact that the German people were manipulated through right-wing propaganda to a point where the government itself was seen as an enemy or at least an impediment to German progress, both politically and socially. Therefore, the overthrow of the government, in a sense, actually became quite chic, or certainly a drastic change. In addition, in Weimar Germany, a lot of key democratic leaders were assassinated by elements of the national security establishment. We've seen the same thing happen in this country with regard to Dr. King and John Kennedy and others. And my fear is that the mentality that Oliver North represents, the stab in the back mentality, which I think Oliver North's blaming of this country's defeat in Vietnam on the protesters echoes in a very precise fashion, the stab-in-the-back thesis that the Nazis promulgated in Weimar Germany, in which Germany's military defeat at the end of World War I was blamed on the abortive German Revolution, whereas, in fact, the German Revolution was spurred in no small measure by that military defeat, which was already assured. Nonetheless, the notion that these pinkos, these commies, these subversives in the back somehow stayed Germany's mighty military hand became very fashionable among the German general staff and the lower ranks. And in considerable measure, the ranks of the Freikorps and later the Nazi Party were filled with zealots who were propelled by that kind of a vision. And I think it's a similar kind of a vision that propels Oliver North and his supporters today. I know this is kind of... And it's in that context, though, that I'm afraid of the thought of the government arming the private citizens with the very weapons it's denying others. That's what I really think is ominous.
It wouldn't be inaccurate to say that for those of us who've been around and alert to just the culture around them over the last 20 years, that there's a distinct difference in the culture today compared with 20 years ago. And I think neglect of scrutiny of and good hard investigative journalism has something to do with that, and we could lay blame on it. But one thing that certainly is accurate that you can say with assurance is that power over time has been consolidated into fewer hands. And I live in Palo Alto, and it's it's a pleasant place, and there are a lot of very wealthy people who live in this town. And yet, if you walk downtown, and I see this day in and day out, I see people eating out of garbage cans in town, and it breaks my heart. But I got to tell you, I really see things have changed over a period of time, and it didn't used to be that way, and it's not a mystery about how it's changed. You can really take a look at a lot of legislative changes that have occurred over time, and it's subtle. As you've mentioned, it's a subtle process, but what is worrisome about the state defense forces and about the California State Military Reserve in particular is that if you read the literature that's associated with those groups and with the California group in particular, there's a lot of stuff within their mobilization plan and within their mission that talks about terrorists and subversives and defending key industrial installations and key military installations. And the question is, well, against who? And who's going to name these terrorists and subversives? Exactly who is that? Purportedly, the reason for these groups and the California State Military Reserve is to replace National Guard when they leave for foreign combat, which is a strange enough notion to begin with. But the National Guard, if you look at the responsibilities of the National Guard since its inception back before 1920, the National Guard has never fought any subversives, at least not that they've admitted to, or they've never fought terrorists. Why all of a sudden is there a group that's supposedly replacing the National Guard that has as its mission to do this stuff? I mean, it's not a group that's around to fight forest fires or for, earthquake response or flood relief. It's pure and simple an internal security force. Well, I'll tell you what the reason for this group is, and it ties into something that you're talking about, and that is the instability of the economy. In my opinion, the economy is in an unstable position simply because it's nearly bankrupted because of the expenditure on military weapons and on the military to sustain a dominion that's gradually declining. I mean, the extent of foreign military bases and international involvement is just too expensive for this economy to sustain, and it's not going to continue. And it was realized that that was the case back when Melvin Laird was the Secretary of Defense. The Department of Defense under Laird instituted something called the Total Force Doctrine, which integrated all of the uniformed services into international military strategy, including the National Guard, which had been traditionally the domestic force available for continental defense. So that by last year, in 1988, the Army National Guard formed nearly half of the combat-ready forces of the U.S. Army. And all of its helicopter squadrons, for that matter. So the National Guard now, which was the, you know, has this dual state mission and federal mission and was here for continental defense, had to be swept into general military strategy because the economy just simply can't sustain a regular, full-time paid military big enough to do the kind of nonsense that's called for by the industrial appetites in this country. So somebody got smart and decided that, well, look, if the National Guard leaves, and the guys who are in the National Guard, you know, are maybe in their 30s, most have completed their military requirements otherwise. They've got families. They're in the infrastructure. Some of them are, you know, all hell would break loose. It would have enormous economic repercussions and certainly social repercussions if the National Guard is either partially or fully mobilized. That's something that hasn't happened to any degree since the Korean War. I mean, there were only 12,000 National Guard in Vietnam, and that was a tiny, tiny percentage of the National Guard in this country. So someone got smart and figured out that if the National Guard is used in appreciable numbers offshore, there's going to be a real civilian uproar here, and that they'd better install an internal security force to take care of it. And that's what these state defense forces are all about, and they are really up to no good. They've run haywire in other states, in Utah, Texas, and in Virginia just a few weeks ago. In each of those states, the governor and the legislatures had to dismantle and reorganize them because of a lot of haywire stuff that came to public scrutiny. Dave, I don't mean to, you know, embroil your audience in a long-winded explanation, but I do want to point out that this Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing is crucial to their being rebudgeted this year. They're asking for $292,000 of state funds. They have been financed to the tune of roughly a quarter of $1 million a year since 1984 in the state. And they have never once in all of that time been used by the governor to do anything, absolutely nothing. I mean, at the Olympics, there were a few, handful of people who were there for crowd control who were involved with this group. But since then, they did virtually nothing.
And we can count ourselves lucky in that regard, I think. Well, we can assume.
Yeah, right. I mean, good. I'm really glad that they haven't been up to anything, at least that's too public. But the question is that when there are people eating out of garbage cans, and there are people flooding the armories without roofs over their head and without food in their stomachs, is it really fiscally responsible for Californians to be supporting an anti-terrorist, anti-subversive group of volunteers who, by the way, are recruited now by word of mouth to fill the cadre? I don't think so. And that's what this hearing is about, and that's why they're being called in.
Well, it's not something, let me interject something at this point, it's not something you need to feel self-conscious about, that is, to say the length of the discussion here, because we have spoken about these state defense forces before in a number of different contexts, including, in particular, the penetration of some of them by explicit neo-Nazi elements, such as the Aryan Nations and groups of that type. And again, the thing that I worry about is if our economy does collapse, there are going to be domestic disturbances. I don't think people are going to deal with widespread economic privation with perfect calm. And this is where I see these defense forces coming in. And I don't see provisions being made to deal with large numbers of poor people, and in particular, large numbers of poor sick people with AIDS, some of the various manifestations, physiological manifestations of the drug epidemics and so forth, the problems of large numbers of urban poor people or large numbers of homeless poor is becoming a major issue. And I don't see the society making any provisions for dealing with these people now or in the event of an economic crisis, a drastically increased number of people like that. And what I'm afraid of, and again, perhaps this will seem to some listeners paranoid, but when you take individuals and you place them in a surrogate federal role, such as these defense forces are going to be functioning, and given the political inclinations of some of these individuals, when you're distributing guns to people of that type, I wonder if that is going to be the provision for these large numbers of homeless people.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, for one thing, I'm a little tempted to play some excerpts from tape-recorded interviews I have with some of the people at the battalion level on the air. It would take me a minute or two to get my recorder. And
if you want to do it, I can certainly, in fact, I have an ID coming up here, and I can blab here for a couple of minutes and fill people in on some other information, and then if you would like to let it roll.
Okay.
Worst comes to worst, we can always take a musical break. Again, don't feel self-conscious about taking too much time here, because this is not only a subject that we've dealt with in the past. My guess is that a lot of the listeners are sharing my response in particular to that M1 project. Let's just say that my physiological response to that information is such that I'm being very leery of where the cords and electrical outlets are on the floor here. You know,
The suggestion is by the guy who wrote the letter that I received was that this had something to do with state defense forces and an understanding that the people who subscribed to this program and got the guns were part of the militia, and that they were getting therefore tacit approval about what they would use it for from the government. But, you know, I have no information about what the notion behind this program is. I mean, maybe it's just that they want to get rid of guns that are surplus, but it would seem to me that the way to do that would be to, you know, do it the way other government material is disposed of, and that would be to, you know, get rid of it by selling it by bid to qualified buyers.
Sure, just call Sam Cummings from InterArms if you want to dump a bunch of rifles. I mean, they could do that easily enough. It's the distribution of these things in conjunction with the military, and I think we can assume that the military has at least some information on the political inclinations of the people they're giving these guns to. That would seem to be standard
procedure. What is the Office of Civilian Marksmanship, I'd like to know? And that's what it's called. I mean, your listeners should give them a call and ask what's up. It's certainly worth scrutinizing, and I'm not really sure it has anything to do with state defense forces, but it's just an interesting anecdote. And when you talk about a culture or a population that could be socially destabilized, that's a very real threat for any community, particularly when you have a population that is kind of politically not inquisitive, and a press that is not equally uninquisitive, and is just oblivious to the possibility that there could be some people who would want to do things who aren't not in the community interest, and you begin to see a lot of the federal documents, the kind of nonsense that occurs underwritten by our tax money, and you begin to understand that there's always some component within the community that's ready to do hijinks for whatever reason, for adventure or for personal selfish gain, and we have to be vigilant. We have to be politically aware. We have to be inquisitive, and we have to demand from our radio, from our newspapers, I was going to say television, but that's such a lost cause, we have to insist that they get the story straight on this and that they cover news that really is of worth to the community, not news about, I like Lucille Ball and she was hilarious, but somehow I don't know that her death warrants, you know...
The earth didn't tilt on its axis with her passing.
Excuse me?
I say the earth did not tilt on its axis with her passing.
No, and of course Lucy will always be with us, and her spirit is here, and we'll be able to reminisce about her through her reruns and so forth, but I don't know, 60-point type on a newspaper for a headline about that when things of this nature are going on, and I want to tell your listeners that it doesn't take any great amount of digging to uncover this stuff. I mean, this is not something that takes years of reconnoitering and living in Washington or having a stethoscope to a Pentagon wall to find out. All it takes is a few phone calls, and you'll get more than enough information to absolutely blow your mind with some of the stuff that's being funded by our tax money. And so let's just confine the discussion to the California State Military Reserve that has been rolling along for 5 years, has not been once used by the governor to do a damn thing, and that is operating under a mobilization plan which has been just published in January. This is not an old document. This is brand new. And it's 125 pages of the most far-fetched kind of lunacy going. They're talking about subversives and terrorists and on and on and on and on and on. And how are they supposed to identify who a subversive or a terrorist is? And what is the suggestion that we've got that to worry about? I think there are a lot of immediate dangers that I don't think we really need the visionaries in the state military department to alert us to Soviet proxies on our soil. I think that we can trust our eyes and see real immediate dangers the community faces that warrant that $250,000 expenditure every year for this stupid agency, instead to be directed to some social programs to relieve people who are going without food and who don't have a roof over their head. Mm-hmm. If you want to hold on, if you're going to do your ID, I'll dig up this. These are excerpts. I'm doing a couple of radio features on this thing, and these are just little tidbits from some people in local battalions that will give you a flavor for who's involved.
Tell you what, Ed, let me give an ID, then there are a couple of more thoughts I had. Don't worry about the time factor unless you're pressed yourself. I'm taping what we're playing here, and my guess is this is certainly of great interest to the listening audience. A couple of questions. I wonder if you would have any objection if I put this on file with my tape duplication service. It would then be available on a permanent basis for listeners to hear some of this information. And also, if you don't object, I could distribute it to other stations which do air these tapes. Because I'm taping this right now. I'd like to make this available on a permanent basis for the listeners, which I'm in a position to do. That way people who may be hearing this in a car and would like to sit down and really dig into this stuff would be able to access the tape.
Well, Dave, I'm very glad to do that. I have a couple of reservations. I'm working on a feature now for Other America's Radio,
uh-huh.
A half-hour feature, and also 3 5-minute segments.
I know Eduardo pretty well. He also works at a couple of stations I work on.
Okay, and so. For public interest video. And I don't think they care about who gets the word out. I sure don't.
No, I don't think there'd be any problem there.
The other reservation I have is that I'll tell you precisely what I know about these groups.
Sure.
And I work in a very careful way. I don't say anything that I'm not able to document, mm-hmm. at least like 2 or 3 different ways.
Yeah.
So anything that I say, I've got either a document for or I've got corroboration by somebody on tape who's agreed to be interviewed, who's in an official position and knows this stuff. So it's all direct information.
Well, that's why you'd mentioned that to me before, and indeed on this program I use a specifically pedantic approach for that reason. I mean, not only are you, you know, CYAing from a legal standpoint, but also, frankly, when you're dealing with this kind of thing, a lot of people are inclined to disbelieve this unless you can come up with a supporting information. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you can be as right as can be, but it's really the presentation that counts, and,
yeah.
and it's really doing things in an absolutely measured way and being able to document everything that you say that I think ultimately convinces people that there really is something that warrants scrutiny. And with all of this stuff, I mean, some of it gets to be mind-boggling. Some of it, particularly that distribution of M1 stuff.
Well, not only that, but the distribution at the same time, as I said before, is they're restricting, and so visibly, this is such a national spasm with these assault rifles, but in particular, excuse me for interrupting, but those things going on, because this dovetails, this gets us to one of the things I wanted to ask you, or wanted to comment on. You were talking about the obliviousness of the public, and this also intersects directly with one of the themes of the prepared portion that I'm going to be coming to later, but something that just blows me away, and I think relates directly to this, is the intrusion of the military into civilian law enforcement to deal with the drug threat, leaving aside the whole issue of the national security establishment's involvement in the drug traffic, which was highlighted in a big way with the Iran-Contra scandal. People are sitting around taking, and apparently with no great notice, what to me looks like, if not the most significant, one of the most significant constitutional alterations in the history of this country, which is the introduction of the military, particularly into Washington, D.C., but in general, in a civilian law enforcement role. We're seeing Pentagon defense specialists and the National Guard and others being introduced in the nation's capital in a civilian law enforcement capacity.
Yeah,
and this is enormous from a constitutional
standpoint. Is absolutely essential that everyone really take a look at and slow down and examine very closely, because the involvement of the National Guard in assisting civilian law enforcement is a high priority and has, particularly in the last few months, been a top priority at the National Guard Bureau, from my understanding of talking with people in the Guard Bureau there, in drafting their role in this assistance to civilian law authorities. Now, I'm going to tell you something that I cannot document right now, but that I have on the authority of someone else who's been looking into this kind of nonsense, who's a woman named Diana Reynolds, who's in the Cambridge area, who works at the Edward R. Murrow Foundation. I think it's a journalist foundation at either Tufts or one of the other universities up there. I think she teaches at Merrimack College. And anyway, she had called me on several occasions, and we've talked about what she is taking a look at. One of the things that she told me that I'm unable yet to document is that in the drug bill that was apparently an extensive drug bill passed last year, that there is a provision within that bill that is now law that allows the executive to declare an area an emergency area and to therefore be able to call in the military contingents to enforce civilian law. In other words, it would be martial law, and that is now a national law as a result of that bill. She has a copy of the bill. I'm sure it's not difficult to get it all. I haven't seen it, but at least that's what I'm told. And that really is something that we should definitely be concerned about. The other day there was a program that I happened to watch. It was about 2 in the morning. It lasted to that Ted Koppel special that was broadcast from Washington. And as it turned out, I thought it was a really excellent program toward the wee hours of the morning here. But they did have a guy who was the second in command of the National Guard. Do you know what program I'm talking about?
No, I didn't see this. No.
Yeah, actually, it was a great program. I didn't see the first part of it, and I don't want to digress here too much, but it was a program broadcast from a church in Washington, D.C., in a predominantly black area, presumably. Everybody there was black, and it was an interview, a town meeting. It was called a town meeting, and it was specifically to address the drug problem in Washington, D.C., and it had been preceded by a segment that I did not watch. It was a film dealing with the murder rate in Washington and how it was related to drugs and so forth, and what potential solutions to this might be. The subsequent part of the program that I did hear that went on for about 2 hours, until about 2 in the morning, was extremely interesting. And I got to tell you, people who were in the audience knew precisely what was going on. They were very sophisticated about what was going on in their community. And he said the suggestion that more law enforcement was going to help was absolutely not the case, that this was a problem that probably was being generated from outside the community, that after all, the people in the community didn't own the airplanes, boats, and trains that were smuggling large amounts of cocaine into Washington, that ownership lay outside the community someplace. And anyway, to the point, the guy who was second in command of the National Guard happened to be at this meeting, and he stood up and spoke and insisted that the role of the National Guard in drug enforcement would not be to actually administer civilian law, that was not the duty of the military in this country, and I'm sure glad that he said that much at least, but that their role was secondary in nature and as a backup for civilian law enforcement. Well, that sounded pretty vague. I'd like to know exactly what backup means. And in fact, he was asked that question, and he said that, well, it means driving transports, or it was all very vague.
I think von Clausewitz, the German military theoretician, put it, war is the continuation of politics by other means.